Hello and welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
Borgman's helped me to understand and to reaffirm things like shared meals, musical performance, worship, even like craftsmanship. All those things are part of focusing us, giving us a grounding as human beings that we don't want to lose in this era, and that we can reaffirm, and we almost really are obligated to reaffirm for the sake of our own humanity.
As you all know by now, we at AI and Faith are fortunate to have a new executive director joining us a few months back. We were thrilled to host him on the podcast and to introduce him to all of you when he joined in the fall. And today, a few months into his tenure, we have invited him back on the pod to see what he has learned and what he has planned for the future, and to ask him a few questions from our AI and Faith community. So let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us again. It is great to have you.
It's great to be on the podcast again, Gilad. Thanks for all your work on this, and
absolutely.
Happy 2026 to you.
Yeah, and to all of our community members as well. So before we jump in with the real questions, tell us a bit, how has the first few months been?
You know, it's been really, really exciting and almost like breathtakingly dizzying, you know, or dizzyingly breathtaking, one of the two. There's just so many great people that are a part of AI and Faith. I mean, you're one of them. I've really enjoyed getting to know you and having some time with you in person. And then just, you know, AI is so exciting. And it's like,
absolutely.
Not only is it involved in so much of life and culture and thought and everything else, but also it is always evolving. So like I'm kind of into my 100 days now of being the executive director. I'm just over that, but let's call it the 100 days reflection.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bet you if we had asked the same question 100 days ago, we're going to ask today about where AI is, the answers would be somewhat different, you know, and you know that as well as I do, but that's what makes this like breathtaking and kind of dizzying, this position that I'm in.
Yeah, absolutely. I always joke that I'm that annoying speaker who has to have the slides change the moment before my speech, because AI is changing so quickly that whatever I wrote last week might not be relevant anymore. And we certainly all know that. Now, before we jump a little bit deeper, we want to kick off with a very high level question. So we have some new listeners who are joining us in the pod for the first time and some new members of the AI and Faith community. So starting really broadly, how do you describe the purpose and the mission of the organization? What are we trying to do here?
Well, I do want to make sure, like you just said, that we welcome anybody who's new to the podcast. So there are so many great people that are on this podcast. So make sure you go back and hear some of those episodes. Yeah. Well, you said it really well in the intro. So I'll just add to, you know, our mission of AI and Faith, which is, by the way, our mission is a topic that I've been asked in the past 100 days or so. It's like, how are you and why are you bringing the insights of religion into this completely contemporary context? So insights of religion tend to be things that have a long past to them, right? And what do they say to the present technology? And I think it's this, that the insights of religion have been tested through time. And there's a reason that religious traditions stick around. It's because people find their stories, their ethics, what they do for community really important and life-giving. And so by joining with other religious traditions, I mean, most of us come from religious tradition in AI and Faith, we can learn what are the common threads we have, what has the wisdom that's come through those told us, and then how can we be part of helping AI develop in ways that are, I love this phrase that I'm going to draw from some other meetings that have been, safe and beneficial, right? So we do want safety. We want to protect people's lives, people's livelihoods, people's health, all that sort of thing, which is incredibly important. And also beneficial, you know, how can we partner with AI and co-create, you might say, with AI in ways that are really something that's good for us. I've been using this phrase, as I know, you know, Gilad, an AI that's made for us and not contrast us for it. I draw this from religious traditions that have influenced me a great deal, both the Jewish and the Christian religious traditions. And I think that's one way that religious traditions can help shape the way that AI unfolds. It's not just about finding the most powerful AI, which is obviously incredibly important, but it's finding an AI that helps us flourish as human beings, and religious traditions help us to understand what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And that's exactly the reason that I'm so passionate for our work at AI and Faith. Now, the first outside question comes from our founder, David, who spent so many years helping us build the organization. And he said, as we all know, one of the strengths of AI and Faith is that it's not tied to any single religion. It's really pluralistic. And we have to learn from so many faiths and so many traditions. How do you and how do we as an organization hold space for so many faiths and so many traditions within our community?
Well, I think part of that always begins with listening. And, listening is such a part of religious traditions. I think of how Buddhist tradition has a strong sense of being quiet and mindful. It's also true in, again, I'm as a Christian in the spiritual tradition I'm in, that before we are ready to hear a word from God, there's the time that we are silent, and that silent space is so important. So one way I think to build this interreligious strength is through listening to one another. And I'll just give one example, well, actually two examples that come together. I taught for 11 and a half years in a religious studies department at California State University, Chico. Just retired from that to make enough space for AI and Faith. And in that department, we had an interreligious conversation, a very respectful and nurturing and beneficial conversation among different religious practitioners and academics and specialists. And then also being involved in the American Academy of Religion, which is an interreligious academic organization. I've been involved with that for the past 25, no, 30 years, actually, both as a participant and as a leader. I've learned that by creating space in terms of listening, you can just gain so much. So that first step is listening. That first step is listening. The second step is then to have a respectful dialogue. And I think I mean, this sounds so simplistic, so I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but as we get into the dialogue, we realize that there's so much we can share that is really powerful. And I don't know, my scholarly academic side makes that just sounds so simplistic, but it's simplistic because there's a deep truth to it. In places where we're so polarized in our communities and our country and our culture, it's still actually profound and refreshing to realize we talk across differences, in this case, the differences of religious traditions, and we learn from one another and we find, oh my goodness, there's so much good about this. And then I think there's that other stage we come to, which we do thoughtfully and carefully, is here are some differences we have. How can we work together with those differences? How can we respect and celebrate those differences and actually come to a kind of, I'll use a word that I've used in an academic paper that was just published, a multi-perspectival approach to religion and technology. And I'd be happy to go into that, but just to say it respects the polycontextual elements we are. We actually are in different contexts, different commitments, and yet we come together respecting those different contexts and perspectives and finding some deep common ground and even some places that we're different and that we love and respect in one another.
Yeah, I love that. And I will just echo that has always been my experience in these pluralistic environments. There's so much we can learn from one another. And there is just so much in common between what we're trying to do in this world, which, of course, is why I'm so passionate about this organization.
Do you mind if I add one thing to that, Gilad?
Please.
So for this book, I just, well, actually now it's a couple years old, Science and Religions in America, A New Look. One of the things that was so good in my experience of writing that book was I decided I wanted to write about each religious tradition with the person in that tradition nodding their head in agreement that you are representing what I say accurately. So every chapter in the seven religions I looked at, I had a specialist from that religious tradition give me, here's the context, here's some backstops. In other words, here's places you don't want to go because they don't make sense or whatever, that kind of backstop. In that process is what I'm highlighting here. It was, again, so good. Like I learned, I found the commonality and community we could share across religious traditions, and in this case, academic specialties. So I guess I'm just continuing to reinforce how good this interreligious work can be. And I think why it's one of the strengths of AI and faith.
Absolutely. And this is a really nice segue to one of the next questions we got from our community. The question goes like this. It says, much of your work over the past decade has involved educating pastors and other faith leaders about the many ways that better understanding what science offers and how it works can actually help their congregants better engage with the mission of their faith. So what are some corollaries? What are some opportunities that we can look at the work for AI and faith that may help us to actually further some of the goals of our own faiths?
Yes. I mean, I think pondering whether I've put this statistic into the last interview, and I can't remember, but There was some work that I did in a John Templeton Foundation funded grant, a 3-year grant that brought science to religious communities. These are Christian communities. And we then, after we finished that 3-year grant, we went back and said, did we make a difference at all? You know, we did a report with another grant, like, what was the difference that was made in these 35 or so communities? And here's the thing that I'm getting to. We found that about 85% of the persons that we interviewed said they grew in their religious practice and faith and the vibrancy of their faith by engaging science and technology. So that's, I think, one of the first things that can come out of this engagement with religious communities. We find that, you know, our faith, our practice can engage in the world that we actually live in and can be informed by it. This is going to get more into science than technology, but it's related to how we use technology. One of the things that, you know, has been so powerful are the studies, let's say, of Buddhist mindfulness practice and how, you know, so many of the way we use our devices, whether it's social media or engagement with AI, creates an ongoing inattention and can create anxiety ultimately. We're moving from one thing to the next in ways that are very fast and that we're not really evolved to keep up with. So we need to take these breaks, and mindfulness is one of those ways to take those breaks. And here's the scientific part. Science, so this is, you know, again, back to the ancient wisdom of Buddhism, is that we need to be mindful. We need to be knowing what we are experiencing without judging it, and that helps us to then move into deeper brain states. This is now the scientific research, deeper ability to engage with technology. Yeah. We move back to it in a technological world. And then a deeper sense of well-being. So here's the point here is like, as we study these ancient practices, for example, scientifically, and then how they help us in a technological world, we see that ancient wisdom, in this case from Buddhist scripture and practice, correlates with scientific research. So that's a way in which we have found that the engagement with science and technology can be very helpful with religious practice. I wouldn't be fair, though, not to also include sometimes science and technology challenges us in our religious traditions. Yeah. And that's the degree to which religious traditions, I'll use a phrase from my own tradition, are reformed, but always reforming. So this comes out of in Protestantism, which is called, you know, the reformed theological form of Protestantism, that we're reformed, yes, but we're always reforming. It's an ongoing practice, and we learn from engagement with culture, with the way that that technology and culture speak to us. So I think it's also a way we get challenged and changed, and that's another positive from engaging with science and technology.
Yeah, absolutely. That really resonates. And, you know, thinking about it from the Jewish tradition, so much of Jewish law and the Talmud and things that have been written since then is really about how do we live in the image of God and that God wants us to live, but in the modern world that we actually exist in. And that's one of the things that I hope our community can help people of all different faiths really figure out how to live according to their faith and the way they want to live in a world with ubiquitous AI, which is going to be the world that all of us are living in very soon. Now, I want to take a personal turn for a second. And I was reading some of your latest writing, so I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit about what happened one December evening in 22 when you kind of felt the sudden emergence of omnipresent AI. What happened and how did it make you feel and think?
I hope it's okay if I answer this by bracketing it with a prologue
Please.
And then a postscript.
Please.
So the prologue is that for me, a lot of engagement with AI was thought experiments, you know, going back to the 1950 Turing test that Alan Turing set up about whether, you know, a computing system could fool us to think that it was in some way a sentient being or, you know, I'm speaking broadly, right? So there were thought experiments. There were thought experiments. Could a computer ever have consciousness? You know, what is consciousness? That sort of thing. And then in December 2022, just after the emergence of ChatGPT to many people in the world, I was hosting a holiday party at my house of the department at California State University, Chico, the Department of Comparative Religion and Humanities. And we had suddenly come into contact with what ChatGPT was going to do for us, or to us perhaps also as academics. You know, what's going to happen to probably the key to assessing students, the student essay. What's going to happen to that if, you know, student essays can begin to be written by AI agents? And of course, you know, now we're like, you know, 3+ years from then, it's gotten so much more sophisticated. How are we going to know when a student is really answering a discussion board? And there was all this, you know, consternation and kind of a little bit of, you know, the deer in the headlights feel of like, we're not sure as academics, by the way, academics who try to keep themselves apprised of new developments.
Yep.
We're not sure as academics what to do with this technology as far as teaching. And so we were all like, you know, having our, I don't know, mulled wine and conversation and figured, you know, just that struck me. It hit, again, you know, people in who listen to this podcast will know that AI has been around for a long time. You know that, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, for a lot of us, that was when, about December of 22, when it really emerged and people were beginning to use it much more ubiquitously or much more broadly. So then about 2 months later, this is the funny postscript to me. We were talking about, let's go back a step. The we is our college or university put together a conversation about what to do with AI in terms of teaching. And some of that same consternation was getting raised. There's, I don't know, maybe 100 of us in the room who were lecturers and professors and so on. And then somebody pointed out, you know, you can write letters of recommendation with AI. And there was this, you know, sense of, oh, yeah, you're right. And I thought it was a little ironic, all the consternation, how are we going to police students from using AI? But when it came to benefiting us as academics and lightening our load, it was suddenly okay and even beneficial. Yep. I think that's a great story because, you know, that's a little bit of the twinning of how we respond to AI, either technophobically or techno-optimistically, you know. And I tend to be a little bit more toward that second category. The beneficial side of AI, partly, not more than partly, I'd say largely because of where I think our religious traditions give us some resources. And yet, that those two experiences, December 22 and let's say March of 23, you know, those for me help me to typologize this dualistic response we have to AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason that stuck out to me is because I believe strongly that in the history books, we will remember early December of 22. And, you know, in my essays, I refer to this new technology epoch as the great commoditization of AI. And I say that the great commoditization started on November 28th, which is when ChatGPT became available to the public. And so for me, I think that that was a time where a lot of us in the world were really beginning to ask ourselves what the world's going to look like as this AI became so ubiquitous. So that really resonated with my experience in kind of the last weeks of 2022. And then the second element, your postscript incredibly resonates. I spent a lot of time on the professional side helping companies adopt AI. And people sometimes tell me, well, this type of person doesn't want it. This type of person doesn't want it. And I always say, wait until they find the use case that benefits their profession or their lives. And all of a sudden, we all become adopters. That incredibly resonates.
Yeah, well, I just want to put in a plug for your work on the commoditization of AI. I mean, I think that's so interesting. So, yeah, I mean, so you can see that in every industry, you know, and in every sector, and even in personal life. I think we'll get to this at some point in our conversation, but I'll just say it now, that a lot of people have a fear about AI. And I did come up with, you know, one survey recently, and this will get to the point in a minute. This is a Pew report from 2025, so just a few months ago. I'm just going to quote it. Overall, Americans continue to be wary about AI's broader impact. 50% say they're more concerned than excited about the increased use of AI in daily life, up from 37% in 2021. 10% are more excited than concerned. 38% are equally excited and concerned. Now, I bring that up because of the, you know, that 5-to-1 ratio, like more concerned than excited over those who are excited. And then, and that's what hits me when I go to congregations, when I go to the general public, is a lot of concern. But as soon as somebody says, oh my goodness, I'm planning a vacation, I don't know, to the wine country in Napa, and I used AI, I used Anthropic to help me figure out, you know, where to go and what to do, or, you know, where the best way for me as a person to enjoy this, all of a sudden, they like it. And it's useful, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way it communicates with us is really makes it completely different from any other technology we humans have ever invented, which is why this is such an important topic for us to be focused on. Now, the next set of questions we got from our community were really kind of at the core of teaching we can take from religion that help us with this kind of AI world and the great commoditization we're living through. So the next question goes like this. Religious and philosophical traditions have been grappling with power, agency, responsibility, and ethics for literally thousands of years. What are some of the key lessons from Christianity or any of the other faiths that you've studied in your life that we can use in this new AI era we're living through?
There's so many ways to look at this question. So I'm going to try to just do two, and I'm sure the listeners will think of others. So the first are the broader concerns for the ethics that relate to creation and to society. So, obviously there's this deep concern about loss of jobs through AI, and that will happen. Now, Gilad, we have a great conversation, and I could learn from this conversation. Let me put it out that way. I don't have the answer about whether the ultimate effect will be job loss or not. I tend to hear things from both sides. So that's a different topic. But people will be displaced. That will happen. That happens whenever there's a new technology. And so we as in religious in communities, have this concern for compassion and particularly the caring for the poor. And so that will, I think, be important for religious communities to say, how will we help people who have been displaced by AI? And that's going to happen in a lot of different industries. I remember it was even, I think it was 10 or more years ago, I was in Burlingame, California, which is either North Silicon Valley or Silicon Valley, depending how you look at it, between, say, Palo Alto and San Francisco, talking to a cancer doctor. This was at a spiritual retreat, and he was a cancer doctor that looked at scans and tried to assess a large part of his job, whether there was malignancy or not. And he said that the machines, the computers are getting better, as good as I am at that. Now, that was 10 years ago. So we can imagine that people who are in a high level, high paying profession like, oncology are going to be displaced. So it's not only people who say are truck drivers at a lower income level, but at a higher level too. And I'm wondering if that means there's a kind of pervasiveness of this. And so I'm going to go back to the religious community side of this is, how are we going to care for those in our midst who are displaced by their jobs? The second part of this, I think, is this interfaith and interreligious concern for the environment. And if we want to link in show notes or whatever, we could talk about, some of the statements that have come out. But I can just say that, like, every major religion has a positive statement about creation care. So what are we going to do with the use of water and energy that data centers are presenting? And I think that's, an ethics for creation that is really significant. And I know you've talked about that on some podcasts. So I'll just note that. Then there's the kind of personal side, and this is where I think religious traditions can speak in terms of practice. I was actually just this weekend at a church congregation in Connecticut talking about the importance of Sabbath, which of course is a Jewish and a Christian tradition. We Christians picked it up from Jewish roots, right? And the call to find a sanctuary in time, as Abraham Joshua Heschel talks about. And I think that's really important. That helps give us agency over technology, over the pace that life can move. And, there's tech Sabbaths that have been in place for a long time as part of Sabbath. There's just the rhythm of Sabbath to move a human pace to create notes and spaces, is what I would say from my experience as a drummer. I'll just give that last piece and then we can go on to the next question. One of the things that we have as drummers is we don't have, let's go back a step. One of the things we don't have is melody. So what we have is rhythm, and rhythm is based on notes and spaces. And drummers, when they're young, love to learn how fast they can play. And so young drummers, inexperienced drummers, tend to fill up the spaces a lot, with a lot of notes. And, that's cool. It's fun. Every drum solo is about how fast the drummer can play most of the time. And people love that. It's kind of, it is dazzling. But great drummers also use space really well. And space creates the place for other musicians in jazz, which is my primary training, other musicians to improvise and to create their own area of, but this is true of, pop and rock and so on. So great drummers use notes and spaces really well. And I see the practice of Sabbath, and Sabbath actually, if you broaden it out, is a part of many traditions. If you just talk about rest and work, the Buddha took times every year during like the monsoon season to pull back from his teaching to take time to rest. So it's something we could say is a broader theme of rest. And so this rhythm of notes and spaces is what makes good drumming, also makes good rhythm in life. That's one way we can also look at our religious traditions and ancient traditions speaking to this modern contemporary practice of how we engage with technology.
I love that. The very first thing I ever published for AI and Faith back in 2019, a million years ago, was all about the way we could use artificial intelligence to honor and uplift the Sabbath and actually use it to think. Because if I think about Shabbat from the Jewish perspective, right, it's about worship, it's about study, it's about rest, it's about family and friends. And there's so many ways we could use AI to lift that as opposed to supplant that. And I love that answer because I so believe in the importance of that rest and the Sabbath concept. The other element I think we need to study in religion to bring into our world is how to share the wealth. What obligations do we have to our neighbors and to our fellow citizens in a world where AI's wealth will likely be concentrated? I think there's a lot we can learn from our faith traditions to try to bring AI into the future in a way that benefits all of us individually. And I really love that answer. Now, the next question came all about the grounding and the AI era and some of the philosophy that you shared from Albert Borgman. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that and a little bit how you think about kind of grounding, religious grounding in the AI era.
Yeah, Borgman has been really helpful for me. So Albert Borgman is a philosopher I think he's retired now from the University of Montana. He talked about what he called focal practices. So I may have actually put this into another podcast. So if I did, let me just repeat, I guess, that focal practices are, you could say, are practices that focus us. And it comes from this Latin word focus, which was the fireplace. And the fireplace was where the ancient Roman family would be involved in things like cooking and conversation and time together. And so I learned from Borgman that there's this importance of focal practices that technology can so often interrupt. When I was a kid, I ate dinner with my family. That was a big commitment pretty much every night. Fairly traditional family structure. My dad would come home from work. My mother and my father would put together dinner. We'd sit together, my brother and I, and we'd have this family time together. And I learned a lot during those family meals. That's what Borgman would call a focal practice. And he said that a lot of technology interrupts that. When I was a kid, I used to love to watch Speed Racer, and I could only watch Speed Racer when it was on. There was no like TiVo or, you know, whatever else, you know, like recording of digital content, video digital content. And so I had to do it at a certain time. Now, the way we do that today is we'd have our content on our phones or our devices. We'd probably take the meal often and we'd, you know, put it in the microwave. It was needed to be heated up, and we'd be in our separate times and places and places of, you know, focal attention to be involved in eating. And Borgman says that that's where technology's gotten in the way of what is a really key focal practice of eating together. Borgman's helped me to understand and to reaffirm things like shared meals, musical performance, worship, even like craftsmanship. All of those things are part of focusing us, giving us a grounding as human beings that we don't want to lose in this era, and that we can reaffirm, and we almost really are obligated to reaffirm for the sake of our own humanity.
One of my most used lines on stage these days is, in a world of ubiquitous AI, the human connection is the best differentiator and it's the best superpower. So our audience all know that I've got two toddlers at home, and we do a very traditional family dinner every night, and we sit together without our phones, talk about our days, what we've learned. And I so believe in the power of that, and specifically that kind of human connection over human things like food, like walking, like religion, like around the fire. I love that.
Now, when I was reading, I know this is supposed to be an interview of me, but can I ask you a little bit more about that? Is that right?
Please. Yeah, of course.
So I'm really fascinated. I mean, I'm not fascinated that we're connecting on common themes, because we do that off the microphone and stuff.
Yeah.
So when you do that and you talk about it with your audiences, what is the response from people about the need for human connection? You know, how do people push back? Do they resonate, or how does that?
No, I will tell you, the response is jubilation, and they're almost thanking me for saying it out loud. I really think that we as humans, we need each other. We were created to be in community with other humans. And I think a lot of us have lost that. And I think if we look at society and politics and all these things, it's because we've been pulled apart. So when I say, what I need you to do for the future is to dine together, it's to speak together, it's to walk together. People, it's always like, you don't need my permission, but if you feel like you do, here it is. So that's what makes me very optimistic, that I think a vast majority of us, and I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley and places with, you know, technology wizards, and all of them believe in this. And I'll say also, one of the most common known things for those of us who spend time in Silicon Valley is that all the people who built the iPhones and the iPads or whatever do not give their kids a lot of access to those screens. And I'll say, as a classic millennial parent, we also are quite strict with our kids in terms of their time with screens and devices. But I'll just finish by adding that it's a difficult balancing act. I would say professionally, the reason any success I have came from my dad exposing me to AI and technology when I was quite young. And that has been an advantage for me in my own career. So thinking about how do I balance all these things for my kids? How do I give them exposure so they have advantages in the future without robbing them of this core element of humanity, of human connection, of the importance of human community with other humans, I think is a challenge. But again, I'm optimistic because I think it's one that almost all of us, almost everyone I interact with has the same end goal, is how do we use AI to elevate our humanity as opposed to replace and cement it. But I'm working on it every day. I love that.
See, the part that's affirming for me too is not only are you deeply in the industry itself, but also you're younger than me. So I always wonder, it's just because I'm, not a digital native that I feel like you have to have real community. And
yeah,
I don't think that's true, but it just helps to hear from somebody that you really do need. It helps to hear from somebody who's younger that you do need real interaction in real time, in co-presence, all sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. And again, if you look on the commercial side at the industries that are flourishing, outside of the people building AI, of course, they're flourishing. But it's things like entertainment, it's things like food and beverage, it's things like travel. These highly human experiences are the industries that all of my investor friends want to be investing in the future, which again is another kind of positive data point that I look towards the future and say, yes, I want more opportunity to come together with other humans to have shared experiences. And that's what keeps me optimistic.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So now let me ask you a couple more questions because we could speak for hours and we are going to run out of time soon. I read something you wrote that really resonated with me where you said, our fallenness means that AI will mirror and magnify our injustices unless we act to resist that outcome. What are some things we can do to resist that outcome?
I want to just put in there, just to make sure that the word fallenness has a footnote here, that it comes from the Christian tradition that there is a propensity to do evil that we call, we put under this rubric of the fall in Christian tradition. There's a lot of ways this has worked out, but there's just a way in which human beings take great things and twist them. And I believe that's one deep way of reading the early Genesis text is given power and we begin to use that power in ways that distorts the world. And we become, distanced from, in this case, it was Adam and Eve, our partner or our partners, to broaden that. We can become distanced from the earth. There's the text in Genesis about the ground will be harder to cultivate and all that sort of thing. And I think that's a way that we misuse our freedom. And I think that AI will magnify some of that misuse of freedom unless we're careful about it. I'm going to go back to what the careful part is in a second. But one of those things is that we naturally give power and privilege to those who already have power and privilege. So I think you mentioned it earlier in terms of compassion and religious traditions. Like, it is natural that wealth and power concentrates. And so it seems to me religious traditions have ways that we want to push back against that. And lest that mean that I think we all have to have an equal amount of wealth and power, I don't think that's not what I'm saying. Yep. I'm just saying when we have people that are suffering, religious traditions say that we want to create a society in which those who are suffering are minimally cared for. And also as an American, given an opportunity to then create livelihood for themselves in various ways. So that's the first thing. And I think one of the other aspects is representation in AI models. So this is really fascinating to me. Like Mohammed Ghaleh, who's part of our AI and Faith broader network, has mentioned in a podcast, if I'm not mistaken, that there are 600 million Arabic speakers in the world, but only 0.06%, let me make sure that's clear, 0.06% of AI programs are trained on Arabic sources. Embedded in some inequities already is a misrepresentation and underrepresentation of Arabic sources. That kind of thing will continue to happen. The 2 billion people that I'm told have really no presence on the internet, meaning they just don't have whatever you want to call it, broadband or something like that, are not going to be present in the models that are trained in AI. So they're just not in the system. And all those things are part of what I would say is the fallenness of human nature and the way in which there's a propensity to create inequities within the systems we have. So now here's the solution, I think. And this is actually, I'm going to sound so constitutional, like it's the, in the form of our government of the United States. But the way that our government was founded, I think, is really great because, and of course, this is under stress and it's always a part of how we have to work in our political system. But the original idea was that there was a sense that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? That's not in our Constitution, but that's surrounded the time of our Constitution. So we set up checks and balances and tried not to give any one person too much power. And I think that's one way that we can model that kind of checks and balances to actively resist these outcomes, you know, so that we don't aggregate too much power to one person or to one industry, and we help those of us who do have power give voice to those who don't have power for the use of things like water and energy as part of this, or representation, so that these AI programs don't reinforce the kind of misrepresentation that's already a part of our society. I'll just make one plug for where that fits with AI and faith, is we want to make sure we, meaning these 200 plus experts, the wider community of AI and faith, that the models have proper religious input, right? That is actually, I mean, that's like kind of a simple thing, really basic. But so if you ask about a, you know, religious tradition that's not very large, for example, let's say the Latter-day Saints, which has about, I think, 14, 15 million people in the world. Prominent in the United States, it is throughout the world, but not a large religious tradition when you think almost 1.4 billion Muslims or so on. So my point is, will a question about Joseph Smith be accurately answered by an AI model? And I was just in a meeting in December at the LDS headquarters to ask that question. You know, what are AI models doing and how well are they answering this kind of question? You know, and I think, so I'm getting a little bit of the weeds, but my point of this is, we want to make sure we have voices now from AI and faith perspective that creates a way in which representation occurs. That's the kind of inequity and injustices ultimately that can be embedded in human systems and that naturally happen. So we have to actively resist those. We have to actively put in voices so that there won't be those kind of inequities and misrepresentations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a critical point. And of course, one of the many things I'm so passionate about AI and faith work. Now, as we wrap up, I want to read this beautiful passage I got from one of your writings. It said, "My work keeps me constantly aware that AI is not simply a technological project. It is an expression of human hopes and fears, our longing for power, our craving for convenience, and our hunger for transcendence and meaning." I found that to be beautiful. And I'm hoping you can finish by telling us a little bit about your vision for an AI made for us. What does that mean?
Well, thank you, first of all, for pulling out that passage. There was another really respected reader of this document that I gave you, an AI made for us, who also loved that. And I this is very moving. So thank you for that. Sorry, I'd be a little emotional. I'm just complimented. And so I'm kind of a little speechless. In my religious tradition, and we share this, Gilad, you know, in the Genesis text, God creates humankind in God's image, right? And part of that is what I would call created creativity. So AI comes out of that creativity. And this is where I would want to be very careful about a phobia toward technology. I think this is actually something that is God-given in my tradition, in our traditions, I would say. I'm just going to speak from ours, but other traditions have similar commitments. Yep. So these are good things. These are good things. And I keep wanting to remind people of that. And for that reason, hopes and fears that are part of humankind are also in AI.
Yep.
And part of that is we really want to be sure that we don't do things that will hurt the poor. The widow and the orphan is the language of the Hebrew Bible, right?
Yep.
Those people are outside of the margins of society. That was how it was in ancient Israel.
Yep.
And we want to care for those. That's the fear side. On the positive side, there is something that's unbelievable about this technology that is so alluring. It's not really that different from, I remember reading about the person who first rode in an automobile and they went 60 miles an hour and they couldn't believe that, you know, after being in a horse-drawn carriage. And so when we look at AI and the way it can take texts and, you know, revise them or can help us to understand a very complicated, in my world, a very complicated idea and break it down, or can give me a way of teaching spiritual tradition, let's say a Bible study or something, and give me some questions that people can ask. I mean, that's like transcendent, you know? And I think that shows us that we can embed this hope for something broader and greater than ourselves in these models. One other way that helps me understand transcendence is what AI does is aggregate human knowledge. And by being able to put our fingers on the greatness and the breadth of human knowledge, there is something that, that literally transcends us individually, but that transcends time and place. And that's why I think AI can be so captivating. Of course, it can be alluring. And as I said, I don't want to ever miss there's a fallenness that can be part of how we use AI, but it can also be something that's powerful. So I will close with, I think, an affirmation for me. And I think this is, I believe this is something I can say that we both share. And you can say, you can tell me if I'm off base on this. If we work together with AI, you know, and create something that's collaborative, I think that can be something that's beautiful and that can be completely resonant with some of the great aims of the religious traditions that are part of life today. So that's the degree that I think AI does embody some of our wishes, aspirations, and even our hope for meaning and transcendence.
That is a beautiful way to end this conversation. And of course, such a wonderful reminder of how fortunate we are to have you helping lead this organization and our efforts. Now, before I let you go, we do have two lightning round questions, 15 seconds apiece, and they're going to be related a bit to the end of the year since we're celebrating the beginning of a new year here together. So my first lightning round question is, what is your favorite holiday tradition?
I happen to love Christmas. I love Christmas because all of a sudden you see, and I love actually the secular side of Christmas. I recognize that the tree, the lights, music, and also the spiritual and religious aspect. There's something that's very powerful for me about that. And finally about, you know, the way that it draws people together in worship, in community, you know, of course, within the Christian communion.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful religious experience for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last question, did you make it to midnight on New Year's Eve?
That is a great question. Laura, because my birthday is on New Year's Eve. So we went out to dinner in Sonoma where we were enjoying some great wine tasting and dinner. And as I recall, we made it to midnight, at least midnight on the East Coast.
Me too. I also made it to midnight on the East Coast. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for being our leader. And of course, I want to thank everyone in the AI and faith community for continuing to engage with us and to work with us together to make sure that AI benefits humanity and all of us individually. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gilad.
Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends so they can join this important conversation. Don't forget to also follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.